ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello and welcome to The Bookshelf here on ABC Radio National and on the Listen app. I'm Kate Evans.
And I'm Cassie McCullough, and this is your home of new fiction releases. Each week we bring you, well, not everything, but some of the best or the most interesting books in fiction from Australia and around the world.
Well, we're heading to India with The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny by Kiran Desai. That's on this year's Booker Prize shortlist, by the way.
And Scott Stevens from ABC Radio National's The Minefield is joining us for that.
And Witch Trials in 16th Century Denmark with the critic B.J. Silcox.
Okay, but let's start with an Australian story, a follow-up to a very popular novel from 2021. The Transformations is the second novel by Sydney author Andrew Pippos.
His debut, Luckies, was about the Greek-Australian diaspora and a chain of cafes, like the ones that used to be found in country towns and suburbs, including the Café Deluxe in Brewarrina in New South Wales that was owned by Pippos's own parents. Now, this book was shortlisted for the Miles Franklin Literary Award and a number of others, and we read it together here on The Bookshelf in 2020. But what's going on with his new novel, Cassie?
Well, this is called The Transformations, and we meet George DeSaulis. Now, he's in his mid-30s, and he's a sub-editor on a fictional newspaper, The National. And he works on a very late shift, getting up at midday and arriving at the paper when the reporters have all sort of finished their copy, and stays through to midnight as he ushers away the final edition. He lives alone in a studio apartment in Sydney's Inner West. His Greek-Australian parents, yes, you guessed it, once ran a cafe in Goulburn this time, and they died very young. He had an older sister, but she's moved to the other side of the world. He also has a daughter called Electra, with whom he has very minimal contact, and Electra was the result of a short-lived teenage romance. So the newsroom really is George's life.
Okay, when though? Because newsrooms have changed so much recently, Cassie. So what sort of newsroom are we talking about
well,
here?
Well, yeah, that's a good point. This is set in 2014 when newsrooms around the world were rapidly changing, closing. It was this sort of moment where old school glamour journalism began to crumble as the tsunami of online information was bearing down on it. There's this shift on with the paper, but also in the newsroom. And the opening scene is at the change of shift where, and it's a Friday, where there's two farewells going on at the same time, two staff members sort of being quietly clapped out of the place after X amount of years. And, you know, this really happened and is still continuing to happen in newsrooms in Australia and elsewhere. So, you know, there's a real sense of precision in this because Andrew Pippos has worked for many years as a sub-editor on, well, the Australian newspaper in Sydney, Surry Hills.
So there's a real sort of poignancy about that change, but it sounds like he knows what he's talking about. So it's not just a cultural idea he's writing about. So is he taking you right into those newsrooms, into the work and the place?
Yeah, and you know, it's beautifully observed, this book, in many, many ways. And George as a character is kind of intriguing. He's very well liked and he's respected and he's part of the inner circles of the journo and production staff of the paper. You know, he's part of the crew that, you know, late at night, adjourned to the nearby late opener, which in this case is called the Nobody, which is quite good. Telling, actually, when we learn more about George's character. But he's an observer of the main drama of the newspaper. He's not a participant. And slowly we realise this is true of the rest of his life as well.
I really like fiction that takes us into workplaces, but is this overwhelmingly a story of the workplace, or do we find out more about George's personal life and home life?
Well, we do. He lives in this one-bedroom flat on his own, but there's actually quite a lot going on in his mind. For starters, each night he has a quiet conversation with his dead mother.
Oh, goodness.
Which is kind of interesting. We also learn very early on that he was sexually abused by a priest teacher at the Christian Brothers primary school that he went to. And, well, he says he's sorted this all out in therapy, but he's not told anyone about it except the therapist. So that's kind of cooking away in the background. But then things really change when this gun reporter, Cassandra Guan, suggests a drink at the Nobody.
Oh.
She is a great character. She's the child of immigrants as well. She's Italian-Australian with a Korean father. And she's actually married with two kids, but this marriage is an open one. It's okay to have sex with other people as long as there's total disclosure.
I am intrigued already with that setup, but it does sound like there's an awful lot going on. I mean, if there are things that he's confronting, not confronting, silences in his household, I mean, how do all these strands play out?
Well, yeah, it's intriguing because this is an almost entirely interior novel. It's a psychologically subtle book where realizations take place, and by the end, yes, a lot of transformation, not only of the newspaper industry, of working life, of this relationship with Cassandra, another Greek myth reference, one I'm very familiar with, Kate.
Yes, you would be, Cassandra.
The prophetess of doom. Electra, the daughter, who he had absolutely nothing, was allowed the most minimal contact with, suddenly rushes into his life. She's 15 and she's not having fun at home with her mother and the man her mother married who has raised her. And there's a blossoming of the father-child relationship there, which is kind of, you know, I mean, she's called Electra. And when the mother decided to call her that, he sort of thought to himself, my God, don't these middle-class white Australians understand what that name means? But the mother had said, oh, well, it's a nice nod to your Greek heritage.
Oh.
And, of course, Electra being the daughter who fell in love with her father. Although in an interview I read with Andrew Pippos about this book, he says that he understands the Electra myth as being what happens when a daughter rejects her mother and sides with her father. So it's more of a transfer of power than a kind of psychosexual mess up.
And so is it all about what's unfolding in the present? I mean, do you find out what happened in his past, why he didn't engage with his daughter when he was younger? I'm just sort of curious about where the book takes you, like whether it's all moving forward or whether it sort of flips backwards as well.
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, and it's probably worth turning to a couple of other reviewers who've talked about this element of it. Nancy Knott, who writes for Arts Hub, said here, Pippos uses mundanity to anchor the reader in George's bustling workplace and book-strewn apartment with a relative peace. That might seem antithetical to producing the necessary conflict of a novel, but in art as in life, conflict is ever present. And she says this passivity is actually, oddly enough, the mechanism that keeps the forward motion of the novel going.
So what does she mean by mundanity? Is it the sort of detail, the texture of everyday life?
Yes, it is highly detailed and very low stakes, or so you think, because these transformations are taking place, but in their own time. So by the end of the novel, everything is totally transformed. I won't say how, but you may not have noticed it coming. And James Bradley, writing in the Saturday paper, says that it is George's abuse that is the true emotional substrate of the transformation. The book has the numbed, disassociative texture of trauma. George's reactions are often puzzlingly muted. At one point he learns he may lose his job at the end of the day and he simply goes back to his desk as if nothing had happened.
So, that's a really interesting observation. Mm. So it sounds like it's sort of quietly powerful. I mean, does it creep up on you then?
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, at some points it's actually quite sexy. And this relationship with Cassandra is wonderfully described. My God, you know, she's a great woman. She's just a legend as a journo. At one point, this kid reporter is getting sent out to do a death knock, and she knows she's going to mess it up, so she goes with her. She's trying to do the best for her kids and for her husband, but she's also got, you know, her pretty firm ideas about what she likes. She's just a great character. The mother, the character George Saulis's mother, had said to him, when you go to Sydney, when you go to town, don't fall in love with the first woman you meet. And he certainly hasn't done that. He's been waiting a long time to meet Cassandra.
Because about how old is he?
He's in his mid-30s.
So he's been around and he's been denying things and not dealing with things for years. So this is the point when everything's coming to a head in his life?
Yeah, because, you know, this relationship he had when he was, you know, about 18 with Madeline that produced Electra, that was already after what had happened at St. Isaac's. So, you know, there is a lot of weight to James Bradley's argument that that is the story, and which isn't discussed much at all.
Well, and I'm sort of wanting to know whether there's a reckoning, but that's what you can't know, because we need to read it to find out how that transformation plays out, I guess.
Well, right at the beginning of the novel, George de Saulis has written an article about this pattern of abuse in this particular area, which was where he went to school. It ran at 11 pages.
Huge.
In the Saturday supplement, you know, that never happens. But it was completely devoid of any of his personal experience and not even a recognition that he was at this school. And it was all done from transcripts and it was all done from third-party accounts. So, I mean, that's another brilliant sort of way of this man not being present in the biggest story of his life.
So, Cassie, it sounds like this book made you think, but so you liked this one?
Yeah, I think this is a really strong, competent novel by someone who has spent a lot of time crafting a narrative that takes you somewhere but you don't see it coming.
That's Andrew Pippos's The Transformations, which is published by Picador.
You're listening to The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National and on the Listen app. Today, our guests are Scott Stevens, the ABC's Religion and Ethics online editor and the co-host with Waleed Ali of The Mindfield, and also critic and writer BJ Silcox. Hello and welcome to you both.
Hi there.
Hey, it's good to be with you.
Now, we're going to get stuck straight into the books you've read for us, because we know you've got plenty to say, and we've got a lot of books waiting for us in the wings.
Yes, because October is the busiest month in the whole publishing calendar, and we're planning to run through some of the other new titles we're excited about as well. So make sure, everybody, that you keep listening right to the end.
So the books you've read for us, BJ, you've read a Danish novel in translation, Olga Raven's The Wax Child, and Scott, you've read Karen Desai's The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny. Let's have a look at that one first.
Now, Kiran Desai is an Indian writer who now lives in the United States. Her first novel was Hullabaloo in the Guava Orchard, and her second, The Inheritance of Loss, won the Booker Prize in 2006.
And yes, she is the daughter of Anita Desai, who was shortlisted for the Booker Prize 3 times for Clear Light of Day, Fasting, Feasting and In Custody.
Now, Anita Desai is in her 80s and she's still publishing. Her novella Rosarita was released in Australia in the last year. But not to confuse anyone, we are talking now about Kiran Desai and her latest book, The Loneliness of Sonia and Sunny. Cassie, you'll be pleased to know that this 670-page long novel opens with 2 sort of family trees. There's one for Sonia and one for Sunny, but it includes family members, servants, friends, and even their pets. So it's a nice version of a family tree.
Scott, even if there is a family tree mapping things out, can you give us the shorthand of it? Where are we?
Oh, really?
Who do we meet in the beginning?
Okay. I mean, look, the book is actually quite extraordinary because even though you are plunged into the life worlds of two sprawling families, the families are kept quite distinct. And I think one of the great achievements, one of the characterological achievements of the book, is to populate the book with characters that are believable and recognizable. So, as the title of the book suggests, we are introduced to these two families, the Shah family and the Bhatia family. Sonia belongs to the Shah family, Sunny belongs to the Bhatia. What's really interesting about it, though, is that the book is drenched. I mean, it's saturated Indian culture, Indian food, Indian custom, Indian prejudice, I'd even say. And yet at the same time, it is a kind of diaspora novel because as we encounter them both, the central characters of Sonia, a young woman who's recently graduated from or is in the process of graduating from a fictitious college in Vermont, she's in the United States, and Sonny has recently completed his postgraduate degree in journalism, and he's in New York City. So we do straddle these two worlds, the world of India and the world of New York and New England. And I think that straddling effect, a process of mutually reinforcing alienation, that really places us right at the heart of the story.
And Scott, one of the ways that she does this, and does it right at the beginning of the book, is take on the idea of loneliness, because it begins in the 1990s and we're in the household of Sonia's grandparents and aunt, and there they are in their rented apartment in Allahabad in the state of Uttar Pradesh, and we get, as you say, we've got the domestic detail, the servants, the food that's being cooked, we've got that texture of daily life. But they're then talking on the phone to Sonia, studying in India. She's weeping, she's lonely, and they are astonished at the idea of loneliness, the idea of anybody doing or being anywhere on their own. It's sort of it's a foreign concept to them, isn't it?
I mean, the action in the novel takes place between 1996 and 2002. It's a really strange window in time in many respects. And the window becomes, I think, important both as a narrative technique, but it also becomes narratively significant as the book goes along. In other words, the distance between Vermont on the one hand and Allahabad on the other is significant. There are no easy forms of connection apart from mutually arranged times to be on the phone. And you're right that the experience of loneliness, and Sonia really is lonely. I mean, she's culturally lonely, but I think more than anything, she is existentially lonely. She feels as though she's teetering on the edge of an abyss. It's America's own individuality, its own self-sufficiency, its own cult of self-reliance. The fact that there's so many things that you're expected to do, this plunges her into a state of alienation. But I think she's also, you know, she wants to be a writer. And she has no idea about her own authorial voice. She has no idea about what types of books she wants to write. And I think one of the ironies then that populates, especially the first half of the book, is what she wants to write, she feels internally excluded from being able to write. She's easy pickings for this villain, and it really is a villain who keeps haunting the pages of this book, an elderly, narcissistic, predatory, parasitic painter.
That older artist, Ilan, he makes a pretty great villain, doesn't he? I mean, as a portrait of a self-obsessed artist, it's really quite extraordinary.
I mean, yes, he is an extraordinary character because he is grotesque. And I think one of the strange things about this novel, I'll confess to you, Kate, my first impression reading it, I thought about George Eliot's World of Middlemarch. I thought about the characterological depth and insight of E.M. Forster, particularly in Howard's End. Karen Desai's novel is a novel that is overtly literate. There's all sorts of references to books, books the characters are reading, books the characters are inhabiting. Most of these books are themselves Western books. I mean, there's Dickens and there's Hemingway. And then you've got the Russian existential books. There is Tolstoy and there is Dostoevsky. So the book itself is highly literate. It's self-consciously literate. And yet at the same time, you have this character of Elon who is monstrous. I mean, he's almost something out of gothic fiction. He's obsessed with his own fame. He is narcissistic. Everyone who exists in his life exists in order to serve him. There's a terrible moment that he inflicts upon Sonia, where having destroyed effectively the contents of his own flat, he gets into Sonia's face, who's dared to defy him, and hisses at her, "You will obey me." I mean, it's an extraordinary form of almost a form of kind of psychological, even spiritual devastation that he inflicts upon her. I need to confess, though, I wearied of him very quickly. He became a parasitic presence within the novel itself.
Well, let's talk about Sonny then, because, yeah. I mean, as you say, it can be a relief when you move away from this, the monstrous character of the artist who does disappear from the narrative for large chunks of the book, which, of course, you can do that because it's 670 pages long. But this is called The Loneliness of Sonia and Sonny. So there is this other titular character, a young man. How would you describe him and his relationship to his family?
Yeah. If Sonia has a monstrous figure in her life in the form of Elon, Sonny also has a monstrous figure in his life. And that's in the figure of Babita, his mother. She is kind of inured to corruption. She's comfortable with class and caste. She is contemptuous of other races. She thinks about herself as being particularly nurtured by the West and more at home in the West. And at the same time, she takes a certain degree of pride in the fact that she has raised her son not really to be comfortable within India or Indian culture. She trains him, she weans him on Western food and then ships him off to the West. The single word I think that best characterizes Sonny is earnestness. Which made me think that I wasn't entirely sure whether he was an ironic character or not for much of the novel. There are certain things that he says, for instance. But this is a passage that I think really captures something about the character and also the voice of Sonny. He's saying something about his own tendency to read Western literature and his own training on human rights discourse. He says that that Indians haven't been schooled in human rights. The language of human rights, the equality of human beings is something that's largely foreign to them. Here's what he says. This is his internal voice, I'll say. Following the repercussions of this lack of understanding of human rights in a logical manner, Sonny thought it explained why Indians would never make good readers of novels. A reader of a novel comprehends the notion of individual rights by the simple act of identifying with a person's, any person's, trials and joys. When you consider another person's feelings, another person's dignity, you actually wish to scrub your own toilet. A good novel reader was a toilet cleaner. And so Indians didn't wish to be readers of novels, as this would undo caste hierarchies and divides that made their world go around properly. And then he continues, Babita, his mother, was not a reader of novels.
Well, see,
I didn't know what to make of this because this idea that reading novels automatically improves a culture is quite frankly ludicrous. But this says something about his own earnestness and his sense of moral superiority that runs through much of the book.
Look, Scott, if someone had told me before I became a professional book reviewer that it was basically just scrubbing out other people's toilets, I might have taken another path.
Although I'm inclined to think that Kiran Desai knows what she's doing and that she's doing something quite playful here about Indian culture, the way that India's perceived, the stories that are told about it. And thinking of stories that are told about it, we only have a minute or two left to to make sense of
you
this
two
one.
Oh, God, promised sorry. Me a love story, me and BJ, a love story at the beginning of this. I can't really see that emerging in headlines.
It is a love story, but it takes, 230-something pages before these two characters meet. Yeah. So it's not a conventional love story.
It's not. And in fact, the irony that stitches the love story together is that earlier in the novel, they were arranged to be an arranged marriage, something that both of them, one of them was unaware of, the other one turned down effectively flat. And so the fact that what was to be an arranged marriage ends up being something that actually brings the two of them together. Again, it's both ironic, but it's also deeply satisfying.
The image that's kind of cute.
It is. The image that continues to appear through the book is that these two have been isolated characters. They've been divorced from Indian culture. They've been estranged from their families. And yet both end up in a kind of river, a deeper connection to one another and to culture that ends up bringing themselves together almost fatalistically. And yet the funny thing about that, again, is that they flow together through to, because of a kind of shared connection to books and because of their alienation in the United States, they end up being introduced to one another as the result of mutually extremely dissatisfying romantic relationships with Westerners. But I think the other thing that really is quite striking here is that to some extent, the characters are strangers to themselves. There's one moment of ludicrous, I think, melodrama where Sonny first sees just the lower half of Sonia's face illuminated by a candle, and he exclaims to himself, "Oh, wondrous life, another candle proceeded from the dark of the house. The air was still, the flame stood reverent. It lit only the candle bearer's magnificent lips of downturned reproach." Again, it struck me as parodic because Sonny is a stranger to himself. The only language that he has within his head is the language of Western novels, in the same way as the only language that Sonia has in her head is the language of this parasite, Elon. The story of the book, then, is how the two of them go from being strangers to themselves to allowing the deeper currents of their underlying culture to almost reintroduce themselves to themselves, as it were, narratively backwards.
I did feel that there was parody, humor, pathos, intelligence, all sorts of things in this sprawling book, and that is...
Hang on. Now, listen, if you're the publisher of this book, put your hands over your ears. Kate, Scott, one word each, 670 pages, was it worth it? Kate?
Yes.
Scott?
No. It reached its pinnacle in the middle of the book, and I felt it was precipitously poorer after that point.
Well, thank you for taking us up that Everest and back down the other side.
And that's Kieran Desai's The Loneliness of Sonia and Sonny, published by Hamish Hamilton. It has been shortlisted for the Booker Prize, which will be announced on the 10th of November.
This is The Bookshelf on ABC Radio National with me, Cassie McCullough, and Kate Evans, and our guests today, The Minefield's Scott Stephens and critic and writer BJ Silcox. This is where every week we talk about new fiction, both the long and the short. So from this epic book, we're turning now to an elegant, well, very slim volume coming in at 178 pages. Not that I judge books in this way, Kate and BJ.
Of course not, although I should add that there is also white space on the page as well with this one, so 178 spare pages by the Danish poet and novelist Olga Raven, and it's called The Wax Child.
Oh, well, we better get that sorted out right from the beginning. BJ Silcox, what's a wax child?
Oh, a wax child is a cursed object. It listens, it waits, it passes things on to its master, and it is imbued with the fingernails and hair of the person you wish to curse. It's a fantastic object, and it has consciousness in this novel. It is telling us the story that it tells to the dirt every day.
Ooh, I wasn't expecting to be so creeped out. That was a fantastic description. So what's the voice of the book then, if it's narrated by this wax child?
Sort of incantatory and lost and strange. Can I read you some? Because I just love the voice of this novel. The year passed and the years passed and I was a wax child. I did not age. I lay in the ground and saw it all. Insects and worms approached to retreat on sensing my poison. I saw the rising of realms, the founding of states, the centralizations of power. I saw the clouds hasten by. I saw the great black tongues of oil advance as the fern from the soil put out its feelers. I saw hands be raised and clench into fists. I saw knives gleam, children play. I saw steam locomotives, the smallest particles split and exploded. I lay in the ground.
Ooh, okay, that is a great excerpt. It really gives us a sense of the imagery.
It's wonderful. It's so incantatory and dark and full of longing.
Hmm. So, okay, this is set in a specific time. Where is it?
Okay, so we're in Denmark in the 1620s. So this is historical fiction, but it takes an unusual style, as you could hear from what BJ was reading for us. And the whole approach is really interesting because she's used court cases, she's used other associated materials from witch trials.
Real ones, you mean?
Real witch trials.
Including spell books and grimoires.
And all of these things she's used in sort of scraps and fragments. And, you know, BJ says incantatory, it uses repetition. So that idea, I saw, there's this character, I saw the quaysides and the marketplaces. I saw the mound with its gallows dripping with rain. I saw a breastbone at the bottom of a tub of ale. I saw a goldsmith melt down stolen goods. So it's a way to take us into that, the texture of the 1620s, but not in an obvious way. And it also does it, which I think is really powerful, BJ, by evoking, well, taking us before the court cases and before people are examined by looking at rumour and accusations. And there's a woman we meet early on. Her name is Anne Biller. Her babies kept dying, usually at birth. By the time she's 32, we're told, she'd born and lost 15 babies. So this is a time of great precarity in women's lives, in what happens with children. So there's grief and tragedy. But what she does is she looks for somebody to blame. And who does she blame?
She's attended upon by a woman called Christenz Krukau. And Christenz is a noble woman with no means. So she has status, but she has no sort of opportunity. And she has absolutely no desire to attach herself or shackle herself or be anchored by a man. And so she has this incredible power, but also no power at all. And also this incredible folk knowledge. So she is attending to Anne, and Anne sort of seizes upon her presence as the reason why these poor children keep dying. And then there's a sort of rumbling that perhaps the folk wisdom is actually a form of witchcraft. And this is where the book gets so wonderfully slippery, because Olga Ravin refuses to sort of conform to the idea that there is no witchcraft and these are entirely innocent women. Actually, perhaps they are witches, and then asks us the question, but what do we mean by witchcraft?
And so what do we mean, I guess? I mean, there's lots of traditions in fiction with witch trials. I mean, you can rattle off a whole list, the Crucible, Arthur Miller, the Scarlet Letter, Nathaniel Hawthorne's probably one of the big touchstones. There's Jeanette Winterson's The Daylight Gate. Actually, even Geraldine Brooks's The Year of Wonders has a witch trial of sorts in it. So, you know, what is this doing that's kind of different, I suppose?
Well, this one speaks really strongly to a book called Hex by Jenny Fagan that came out a couple of years ago, which was bringing Scottish mythology to life, which is told over a single night, the last night that a witch, or an accused witch spends before she's executed. And that's an amazing book. And again, a novella, the perfect size, because I do judge things by their size and I like them small. And so that's a wonderful book about the last night of Gilles Duncan. So this sort of has the same kind of feel to it. Like, we know what's going to happen because the child, the wax child, has seen all and is telling us from a period in the future. So it sits in that kind of space. But what I think this does is, by embodying something that has been created, by embodying an object rather than a person, it really tells the story of what it means to watch and to witness and to be created by someone and then be abandoned. And actually, there's a whole bunch of novels at the moment. I don't know what's in the water. Actually, I do have a theory, but, you know, Keridan Dovey wrote that amazing book about space junk.
Mm.
Chris Flynn wrote about, you know, a retiring aeroplane seat and it's the way it was haunted by all of the bottoms that had sat on it. We have Josephine Rowe, who wrote about the sort of voluble bones of a saint. There are lots of people writing about objects and creation. And on Night Blue, the Angela O'Keefe novel about Jackson Pollock's painting Blue Poles and how it might have a consciousness. I think there's a real interest in the moment about the things we make and what we put into them and then the way we live and how we might be watched by the things around us.
Well, maybe that's just us using these ideas as a way of talking about what's really going on with AI and technology and us under surveillance all the time by the objects we have closest to us, like our phones and our computers.
And also the whole role of memory and objects and material culture, which has done so well. The other tradition that I think it seems to be a part of, although of course there may be entire Danish traditions we don't know about, and I have to say this translation is beautiful, but it did make me think about the way that historical novelists like Hilary Mantel take things that seem like they're lifeless and bring them to life, which is things like lists of expenses and the cost of things and the sort of the quite dry things in the archive. So there's one section in this book where, you know, these women have been tortured and made to confess and, you know, they've been imprisoned and they're waiting the trial. And then there are these voices who decide that they need to look at the cost. What did it cost to burn the cunning girl from Ulsted, they say. I have the expenses recorded in the ledger somewhere. And then we get the list of these terrible costs. They consult their ledger. They read aloud from it. Ale for the executioner, 2 nights, 2 marks. Reasonable by any accounts, they say. Wait, there's more, they say. For 5 barrels of tar, 5 marks. A ladder for the girl, 20 shillings. And the ladder, by the way, is what they tie these women to and then push them into the fire. And it goes through. There's a whole couple of pages of these payments and reckoning the cost of things. And BJ, I thought that was really beautifully done.
Oh, just masterful. It really, the thing that that reminded me of was the list of possessions that Hannah Kent brings out for Agnes Magnusdotter in Burial Rites, how this small bag of possessions can tell the whole life. This sort of accounting for how much it costs to kill a person makes you really think about what it is they're doing. Why are they doing this? Because this is not about devilry and it's not about witchcraft. It's about control. It's about keeping women separate and it's about a very precarious king deciding that he needs to demonstrate to his subjects that he has power. So you sort of see what it is they're really speaking about when they start to speak about money. How much is this really worth doing and what does that worth mean? And it's so chilling and so extraordinarily done.
Scott, you're listening into this. You know, you're the ABC's online editor of Religion and Ethics. The history of witch trials and torture and confessions, that's a huge part of our, well, I guess, inherited memory.
I mean, look, it is. And unfortunately, it has tended to be a kind of parasite on already existing presumptions about the threats of those who are closest to us. Forms of risk and threat and sedition that kind of run through even those things that are kind of most common and most everyday to us. I've not read the book, but I think one of the things that sounds so interesting about this is simply taking things that we have come to associate with kind of seditious or undermining or even malevolent presence and making them intimate, bringing them so close to home, making them objects that are fundamentally objects that have been touched by human tenderness and open themselves up to human affection. This is a very different way of understanding the human in its relationship to the mysterious.
And intimacy is the right word because this is all, there's also a whole undercurrent of intimacy between these women and indeed of sexuality. That's part of the story too, BJ.
It certainly is. And queer desire is part of this as well as women and community. These ideas of how we are close to one another, that might be considered deeply threatening or deeply misunderstood. And so the women are tender with one another and sexual with one another, and they confide in one another, and they share secrets, and they share ways of trying to help one another. And I think that's what comes across so powerfully, is this is a group of women who are talking about things like domestic violence. Are you safe in your homes? Are you loved? Are you cared for with tenderness? Are you safe in your own bodies? And so the things they have that are called folk wisdom or gossip, all the ways that women communicating with one another are weaponized, here become a version of witchcraft. And what Olga Raven sort of does is, if you're going to call these witchcraft, then fine, call it witchcraft, but another name for it is womanhood.
And again, it's part of that incantatory, repetitious stuff that you talk about, is that it's someone said. Yes, every year she lost a bullock, someone said. Yes, that was it. Yes, someone said. And so you get this whole build-up of rumour and speculation until someone said she asked the devil, and it goes on from there. But just briefly, there is something else we haven't brought up, and that is the implications of Kristen's being a noble. And even though she has no means and she has to be a herring wife like the other women and pack herring into salt, and given that this is based on real trials, we discover that most of these women who were found to be believed to be witches were burned. She was beheaded because she belonged to a different class. And so that sort of class, almost caste aspect of it, filters through the book too.
Wow, okay, chilling. And, yeah, quite extraordinary, it sounds like. The Wax Child is by Olga Raven, and it's translated from the Danish by Martin Aiken, who, by the way, is also Karl Ove Knausgård's translator, so must be pretty good at it.
He is pretty good. The writing is beautiful.
Oh, gorgeous.
Thanks so much for those reviews. Now, let's get some recommendations from you both. First to you, Scott Stevens. What have you been reading?
Goodness, well, given that this year is the 250th anniversary of the birth of the great Jane Austen, I did want to mention what I think is one of the best books that has been written about Jane Austen's fiction, especially the way that she ends her novels. I don't know about any of you. I've never found Jane Austen's endings necessarily happy. They're certainly not happily ever after. There's always a degree of ambiguity at the end that I think is both narratively and morally consequential. Inger Sigrund Bredkær Brody has written this astonishing book called Jane Austen and the Price of Happiness, about the sacrifices that characters have to make in order to reach a kind of accommodated happiness by the very end that leaves their future well and truly up in the air. It's an astonishing book. It's actually changed the way that I've read, particularly Emma. So I'd certainly commend that one. The other one that has just captivated me, I'm glad you mentioned the fine art of translation before. Translators don't get anywhere near enough attention in the way that we talk. There's a really interesting book between an author and his translator called Speaking in Tongues. This is by J.M. Coetzee and Mariana Dimopoulos. It's a book in the form of a dialogue about what it means to inhabit a language, what it means to inherit a language. And it just strikes me, at a time when so much translation is becoming automated, having this kind of conversation about what words do to us, whether it is in fact possible to truly be at home with a language other than the language of your birth, other than a language that you were nurtured on at your mother's breast, whether that's possible, this book shook me and thrilled me. I mean, I happen to think J.M. Coetzee is the greatest novelist in the post-war period.
Is that right?
Yeah. He and Toni Morrison, I think, are the two most important. But J.M. Coetzee is very important to me. And his attendance to language really shone through this book, and his act of learning from his own translator.
So this was Mariana Dimopoulos.
Dimopoulos, yeah.
Who's his Spanish translator.
Yeah, she translated his manuscript that came to appear subsequently in English. It was entitled The Pole.
Oh, yes.
But it first appeared in Spanish, and she is an astonishingly deft translator. She's made something kind of work of art in her own right.
I loved The Pole. In fact, on reading it, Kate, you might remember I recommended that this young J.M. Coetzee guy should consider continuing in his career in writing. Yeah. Okay, so that sounds like a great recommendation. And a reminder, we always put every book on our program page, so don't worry. Scott, what else?
You mentioned Karl Ove Knausgård before. I am no fan. He strikes me as the ultimate incontinent writer. He never knows.
Thank you for saying it. Thank you for saying it. I've been holding it in.
At the opposite end of the spectrum.
Controversy today.
You can get me back on to talk about Karl Ove Knausgård anytime you like.
We can do emphatic agreement. Oh, I hate him.
I can hear the roar from the streets.
And from our producer, Sarah Corbett, yeah. Who is a huge Knausgård
Sarah Corbett listening fan. In with steam
no,
coming out of
bring
her ears.
It. Bring him down. If you're going to say Lydia Davis, I love you, Scott. I love you.
Lydia Davis is the master. Talk about someone who understands the work of words and understands how to reduce words to their sharpest point. Anyway, she delivered 2024, she delivered the Wyndham Campbell lecture at Yale University, and she's turned this into a glorious little book called Into the Weeds. It's on reading and writing and editing and observing and writing without intention and being surprised by what you write. Honest to God, if Lydia Davis were a religion, I would convert.
That's great. That is a great title.
Famous, of course, for her very short stories. And I'll just quickly mention Joy Williams, who also writes very, very short fiction. BJ Silcox, what can you recommend to us?
Oh, I'm so glad you've both denounced Knausgård and talked how wonderful Lydia Davis is. I used to joke that I would read a shopping list that she wrote, and then she published a short story that was a shopping list. Oh, I love her so much. I have just eaten in a single beautiful, exultant sitting Lily King's new book, Heart the Lover. And it is my favourite thing I've read all year. It is Austen-esque. You might love it, Scott. It is gorgeous. It is about the way that first love cracks you open and you will always love the person that you loved first in a way you can't love anybody else. But that doesn't mean that you will be in love with them forever. And it is about forgiveness and how two people can part from one another and have completely different versions of why, and that yet those versions are exactly the same story, and it's so beautiful. Oh, and I loved it. So it sent me down a kind of Lily King rabbit hole going back to reread Writers and Lovers, which I loved, and then also Wallace Stegner's Crossing to Safety, which I think is a kind of source code novel for a lot of campus-adjacent books that I dearly, dearly love. Mm. So I've been doing that. But then I also have finagled myself a very secret squirrel copy of Michael Winkler's new novel. He wrote Grimmish a couple of years ago. You'll remember my favourite Australian novel of the last decade.
I loved it too.
Oh, so good. And this is the book that I'm most excited about getting my little mitts on for next year. It comes out in March. It is called Grief Dog, and it is out with text. And to give you an idea of the kind of brilliant subversion of it, it is about a climate scientist, a hydrologist, who inherits a great deal of money and then decides that he would just rather not be a person at all and maybe just be the family pet.
Oh, wow.
And if you loved that Iggy Pop song, I Want to Be Your Dog, this is the novel for you. I think it is spectacular. I'm 3/4 of the way through. I am rationing it page by page because the prose is so incredible and I feel so deeply lucky. Like, the great privilege of my job as a critic is that I get to read things first and, oh, my God, this feels like the ultimate expression of that privilege. So look out for it. Grief Dog, Michael Winkler, coming to a bookshop near you next year, March.
Coming to the bookshelf, Cassie. We'll have to read that one, I reckon.
We certainly will. We're going to throw out some more recommendations here ourselves because October is the big release month for publishers, and we thought we'd give a quick shout out to some of the other books that are worth looking out for.
And actually, given what Scott just said about Jane Austen, the scholar Devaney Lusser has a new book called Wild for Austen, a rebellious, subversive and untamed Jane that's just been published. And I'm very keen to read that one, Cassie.
Mm-hmm. And the Australian writer Sophie Laguna's The Underworld is published this week. Her books include, of course, The Choke and The Eye of the Sheep. And she specialises in kind of weirdly disturbing children.
And I believe she's done that one again. And also there's The Rose Field, which is the Book of Dust Volume 3 by Philip Pullman, which is it concludes the story of Lyra Balakwa from his Dark Materials series.
Oh, which we loved. Yeah, fantastic. Also some memoirs, Margaret Atwood's Book of Lives and Patti Smith, lots of fans, Bread of Angels, both out next week.
So, as always, we'll put those lists on the bookshelf. And to our guest today. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks to you both. Wonderful reading.
Oh, it's been such a pleasure.
It's really a joy. Have me back anytime.
Scott Stevens is the ABC's Religion and Ethics online editor and the co-host with Waleed Ali of The Minefield on ABC Radio National.
And BJ Silcox is a literary critic and writer.
Cassie, you know, there's so many new books coming out at the moment, and as we always say, we can't get to all of them. But some of them, I think, are worth a mention. So Mick Herron, the crime writer who writes that terrific spy series.
What's it called?
The Slow Horses series. His new one is called Clown Town, and that really is sitting there on my bedside table ready for me to read.
And I'm halfway through season 5 of the adaptation. Loving it.
And there's the English writer Claire Louise Bennett. She wrote a book called Pond, which I thought was extraordinary. Her new one is called Big Kiss Bye Bye. That's just out. What else? The American writer Brandon Taylor has one called Minor Black Figures. That sounds interesting. And for people who love an absolutely enormous sprawling novel, John Irving has a new one called Queen Esther.
Wow, he's back.
He's back. And this one refers all the way back to A Prayer for Owen Maney. And I think it's actually a prequel to that one.
So John Irving of The World According to Garp.
And all those other books with wrestlers, bears, happy prostitutes. He has a whole lot of things that he likes to do in his novel, and this one is truly enormous.
Gee, sounds like you're looking forward to that one, Kate.
Well, I did read the last one.
Before you've even had one opening of the page.
Well, you can sort of check whether he's still doing these things. Catherine Newman's Wreck is another one that people are getting very excited about. And in Australian fiction, Ellen Elliot Thomas's Do We Deserve This? Is another one. And I'm just mentioning those, Cassie, even though we're not going to be reading them together, but they're books I think people might want to be alert to.
Yeah, because the downhill slalom to Christmas is on and the books will be coming at you thick and fast. Well, in 2 weeks' time, you're going to be away, Kate, and Jonathan Green will be standing in. The three books we'll be looking at are, well, a big one I'm excited about, Shadow Ticket by Thomas Pynchon.
Oh, that'll be a great discussion. I look forward to listening to that one.
Well, I mean, he's famously sort of circular and arcane at times, mysterious, detail-laden, but kind of fun too. Also, The Silver Book by Olivia Lang, which has very good early press, and something by this woman, I don't know her at all. I don't think you've read any of her books either, Kate.
What was her name?
Jeanette Winterson.
Ah, Jeanette Winterson. Look, I'm kicking myself that I'm not going to be able to read One Aladdin, Two Lamps. Actually, I will be able to read it. I'm just not going to be able to talk to you about it. I'm just not going to be able to be opinionated.
That's one of your rings of hell, isn't it? Okay, so that is coming up in 2 weeks' time. But next week, well, exciting.
Yes, I'm really looking forward to Madeline Gray's Chosen Family.
This is Madeline Gray of Green Dot, her debut, which
went off like a rocket.
It's going to be a screen adaptation. I mean, she is living the dream, rightly so.
And Chris Krause's The Four Spent the Day Together. She's also a really interesting writer. What else are we reading?
Oh, well, this book by a Scottish writer called Graham McRae Burnett, who is a little unknown in Australia, but we've kind of got onto the Graham McRae Burnett train, haven't we? Because I think this is the third book of his we've read.
Yeah, and he is really worth reading. He's really interesting. He sort of writes into all sorts of different traditions.
That last one, I think it was called Headcase, wasn't it? About a woman who thought she might have killed someone and was going to see this psychiatrist, and halfway through the novel something profoundly changes our perception of what's happening. Great writer. So that one I'm looking forward to.
That one used a sort of found manuscript trope. So he really plays around with the form of writing as well. So there were a series of notebooks that we were then
clever.
Reading.
So clever.
So that's on next week's edition of The Bookshelf. So make sure you join us then. I'm Kate Evans.
I'm Cassie McCullough. Big kiss. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.